argument this morning is Morales against Boatwright. Ms. Ball.
May it please the Court, this appeal presents two issues. Whether Morales was denied effective assistance of counsel when his lawyer advised him to plead guilty without recognizing and investigating an available defense. And secondly, whether Morales' plea was knowing and voluntary and made with effective assistance of counsel when he was never told how Wisconsin's truth in sentencing law would affect the potential punishment that he faced. So beginning with the sexually transmitted disease issue, here the State Court of Appeals decision is contrary to or an unreasonable application of Hill and Strickland. Trial counsel's performance fell below an objective standard of reasonableness. The victim in this case claimed that she was sexually assaulted 5 times. It's undisputed that she had a sexually transmitted disease, and Morales wanted his trial counsel to pursue evidence that he did not have a sexually transmitted disease. His trial lawyer advised him that this evidence was not relevant. But the fact that Morales did not acquire a sexually transmitted disease after allegedly assaulting the victim 5 times suggests that he was not the man who assaulted her. Trial counsel missed a defense, and the State Court of Appeals decision is unreasonable because it didn't recognize that trial counsel missed this defense. What the State Court of Appeals ruled was that the sexually transmitted disease evidence went only to the issue of consent, and that's not right. The second prong of Strickland here, where the State Court of Appeals fell down, is in not addressing the prejudice issue at all. But for trial counsel's unreasonable performance here and his advice, Morales would not have pled guilty. It's clear from the transcripts in this case that Morales wanted to fire his trial lawyer. He wanted to fire him because he wouldn't pursue evidence of the sexually transmitted disease. The lawyer and the trial court told him it was irrelevant, so he pled guilty, and when he did, he risked potentially a 100-year sentence if these sentences had been imposed consecutively.
Didn't he confess that he...
He did confess, Your Honor, or rather, I should say, he signed a confession.
That he couldn't control his urges, and that's the reason he...
Your Honor, people do sign false confessions, and furthermore, he disavowed that confession, challenged its validity at a Miranda Goodchild motion, and ultimately what he entered was an Alford plea.
That his confession was freely and voluntarily given in the Goodchild hearing?
That is true, but he's been consistent. The plea was an Alford plea where he's standing by his innocence. Now, what you would come down to potentially at this trial was a confession that he was disavowing and a statement by the victim to the police that it now appeared contained false statements. Also, at the point when his lawyer advised him to plead guilty, it had become known that neither the victim nor the mother were actually going to testify at trial. So I think the fact that he did not have a sexually transmitted disease, and she did, provides him with a plausible defense. And the Shaw case from the Eighth Circuit is instructive here. There, this was not a guilty plea case. It went to trial. But the court faced a very similar set of facts where the defendant did not have a sexually transmitted disease. The victim did, and the Eighth Circuit said, you know, that's enough to get an evidentiary hearing on a Strickland claim. So the argument here is that this court should reach the same result. Turning to the truth in sentencing issue, here's the problem in a nutshell. Morales pled guilty to 2 crimes. One of them was governed by Wisconsin's then-prevailing sentencing system, which allowed parole after serving 25% of the sentence, depending on certain contingent future events. He also pled guilty to a crime governed by Wisconsin's new truth in sentencing law, and that law eliminated parole and good time credits, and it required the judge to impose a bifurcated sentence, including a mandatory minimum period of confinement followed by a period of extended supervision. Now, prior to pleading guilty, Morales was not told that truth in sentencing automatically eliminated parole and good time. But more importantly, he was misled about what the maximum potential punishment was that he faced, because the plea questionnaire advised him that the sentence, the maximum sentence he faced under count two, was 60 years. Said nothing about breaking it down further into 40-20. The judge at the June plea hearing said the same thing. Do you understand that your maximum sentence is 60 years? Then at that hearing, the judge turns to the trial lawyer and says, did you advise him of his maximum sentence the same way I did? And the trial lawyer says, yes, I did. So he was told about a maximum of 60, but what he wasn't told is that under Wisconsin's law, that maximum carried essentially a mandatory minimum of 40 years confinement. And that's where the sort of misleading information comes in. That was a direct an automatic consequence of his maximum sentence under truth in sentencing, and consequently the State Court of Appeals decision is contrary to Brady, which holds that a defendant is entitled to know the direct consequences of pleading guilty, and it's also contrary to Hill and Key, which recognize that there are circumstances where counsel's misinformation about parole eligibility can constitute ineffective assistance of counsel. Now, in this case, we also have to look at the question of prejudice, and Morales' pleadings here satisfy Strickland's prejudice prong. He has specifically alleged that if he had been told about Wisconsin's truth in sentencing statute and its impact, that he would have insisted on going to trial. So he meets both prongs of Strickland. Excuse me. The court should, as a result, step back and consider the combined prejudice of the errors that occurred in this appeal. Morales' lawyer failed to pursue a valid defense, and he gave him incomplete and misleading information about the maximum penalty he faced at a time when the state's case was deteriorating, and then he advised Morales to plead guilty when Morales stood to gain nothing by pleading guilty. It's the same charges, whether he pled or he didn't. And in doing so, he risked a 100-year sentence, and what he actually got was a mandatory 40-year sentence, which for him was life in prison. Mr. Morales asked that this court reverse the district court's decision to grant or to deny his petition for habeas corpus and either allow him to plead over or grant him an evidentiary hearing on his claims.
Are you going to say anything about the timeliness issue at the state? Right?
That was addressed in the briefs, Your Honor, and timeliness all boils down to the question of whether or not Mr. Morales's Knight petition was procedurally irregular or not. That's the Johnson case from this court. And Johnson holds that it is a petition is properly filed if it is addressed by the state court on the merits and not rejected as procedurally irregular. And here, the State Court of Appeals did not reject the Knight petition as procedurally irregular. It issued like a 3 or 4 page decision addressing the merits. And then at the very end, it says, well, if your claim had merits, then it should have been framed as a post-conviction counsel challenge rather than appellate counsel challenge. But that's like saying you don't have an appellate, a challenge for ineffective assistance counsel of appellate counsel on the merits. It's not rejecting it as procedurally irregular. So that's our position on that point. That means he had a valid pending petition, a procedurally fine pending petition, which allowed him to file his federal petition for habeas corpus within the one-year deadline. Thank you, Your Honor. Mm-hmm.
Thank you, Ms. Ball. Mr. O'Brien.
May it please the Court. At the outset, I'd just like to correct a couple of things here. Counsel refers to the confession as a false confession, but the only challenge in the trial court was to the Miranda challenge. There was really no argument that the confession was false, was made up, or whatnot. It was, the argument was rather the standard Wisconsin Miranda Goodchild, that the confession was obtained in violation of Miranda and was otherwise involuntary, and that was litigated and rejected. There was no separate claim that this was some sort of a made-up, fantasized thing. So let's clear that up. Also, counsel talks about the fact that he did not understand he was facing a mandatory minimum of 40 years. There's no such thing as a mandatory minimum of 40 years here. The judge could have imposed a one-year sentence. The only issue is whether it was he should have been told that the truth in sentencing law no longer allows for parole. But the judge could have imposed a one-year sentence or the plea bargain agreed upon recommendation of 8 to 10 years or anything in between up to 40 years. This is not a mandatory minimum. I also would like to, and counsel talks about the that the motion, his post-conviction challenge or his ineffective assistance challenge was sufficient on prejudice because he alleged that he would not have pled guilty and would have insisted on going to trial. But that's not enough. This court's decisions in cases such as Bethel v. the United States says just a mere allegation that I would have gone to trial had counsel done this is not enough. You've got to back it up with a specific offer of proof. That was not done here. So with those points clear up, I'd like to also like to point this court to the no-merit reports filed by counsel and the Wisconsin Court of Appeals decision in August of 2003 with regard to the no-merit reports. I would suggest to this court it would be hard-pressed for it to ever find a more thorough and complete Anders no-merit review than was done by appellate counsel here and thereafter by the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. Counsel filed a lengthy no-merit report, and if you read that report, you see it's clear from reading it that he and Mr. Morales sat down and hashed out what issues Morales wanted to raise, and then counsel addressed those and explained why they lacked merit. Then Mr. Morales filed a pro se response to the no-merit report. That triggered an inquiry by the Court of Appeals. One of the issues Morales raised was whether there was newly discovered evidence. The Court of Appeals asked appellate counsel to look into that and file a supplemental report, or if he thought there was something there, to go ahead and file a separate post-conviction motion raising those issues. Counsel then filed a supplemental no-merit report explaining that there were that the issues Morales wanted raised did not satisfy Wisconsin's test for newly discovered evidence. Then the Court of Appeals went on at length and addressed the only of the three issues that were properly preserved here, the issue regarding the sexually transmitted disease. But then it also addressed whether Mr. Morales was informed of the elements, whether the plea complied with Wisconsin's requirements for a valid plea under Section 97108 and with the constitutional requirement of a voluntary and intelligent plea. The court reviewed the trial court's sentencing discretion. The court reviewed the validity of the sentence, the basis for it, and whatnot. The court found that the plea was voluntary and intelligent. And it's just difficult to conclude, I think, that A, the Anders procedures were not followed, and B, that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals, in ruling as it did, acted contrary to or unreasonably applied Strickland v. Washington. Now, with regard to the issue, the only properly preserved issue, the sexually transmitted disease issue, I asked this court to review the criminal complaint. I believe, Your Honor, you referred to that confession. This wasn't just a blanket, oh, yeah, I guess I did it, officer, now can I go home? This was about as detailed a confession as it gets. This confession corroborated in the most minute details as to time, location, nature of activity of the victim's statements accusing Mr. Morales of sexual assault. It was also corroborated by the fact that the day after the assault, the victim was taken to a sexual assault treatment center and injuries were observed consistent with penis-to-vagina intercourse. regardless of what Mr. Morelli says counsel should have done, there's nothing to support the conclusion that counsel's recommendation to take the plea bargain would have changed. Counsel, even if they somehow proved that someone else gave this child a sexually transmitted disease sometime in the past, that doesn't disprove the confession. Again, now is the first time that they're claiming that confession is false. And it wouldn't change counsel's recommendation and likely would not change Mr. Morelli's decision based on that advice to go ahead with the plea bargain.
Mr. O'Brien, didn't the state make a favorable recommendation for the defendant, 15 years or something like that?
Yeah, I believe the agreed upon recommendation as part of the plea agreement was 8 to 10 years on both counts. And, yeah, that's correct. And the judge imposed a fairly lengthy sentence. I mean, obviously, Mr. Morales did not contemplate the type of sentence that was actually imposed. One wonders, however, had the judge gone along with the plea agreement and imposed an 8-year sentence, let's say, whether Mr. Morales would be here, claiming that his plea was involuntary or his attorney didn't know what he was doing. But again, whether you approach this, well, on the grounds of with respect to the sexually transmitted disease, I think the record is clear, or at least it provides firm support for the Wisconsin Court of Appeals' conclusion that counsel did not act that there was no deficient performance or prejudice here in light of the strong evidence of his guilt that appeared in the criminal complaint, to which everyone stipulated as the factual basis for the plea.
You asked if he would be here with an 8 to 10 year sentence. He wouldn't, because he would already have served that sentence, mm-hmm. Wouldn't he?
I'm sorry?
He would have already served an 8 to 10 year sentence.
Right, well then.
As of today's date.
Yeah, he probably would have had to file sometime sooner, but assuming he had. Theoretically he could be on paper, I suppose, but yeah. But assuming that within that sentence he brought a challenge of this nature, I think that's sort of the pink elephant in the room, is that he got a lengthy sentence and he's not happy with it. And I can understand why. But that doesn't make out a claim of ineffective assistance of counsel, and doesn't make out a claim of an involuntary and unintelligent guilty plea. And with regard to the issue, the elements, whether he understood the elements, I ask this court to review the transcripts, not only of the June 8th plea hearing, but the March 22nd plea hearing that ended with an adjournment where the trial judge explained at length the elements of first-degree sexual assault and got Mr. Morales to acknowledge his understanding of the law in relation to the facts of this specific case. And with regard to truth in sentencing, Wisconsin law does not require a trial judge to inform a pleading defendant of the consequences of truth in sentencing, because it is considered under Wisconsin law to be a collateral consequence of the plea. While it's advisable, it's not required. And again, with respect to whether counsel should have advised him, the record, his allegation that he wasn't advised is only conclusory. There's nothing from either trial counsel or appellate counsel indicating that this issue was ever raised with anyone, and the record seems to support the conclusion that he, in fact, did understand. After all, the plea agreement made a specific distinction between count one, which was under the old law, and count two, which was under the new law, and there was a specific bifurcated recommendation. I believe it was 8 to 10 years confinement followed by a certain number of years of extended supervision. And Mr. Morales knew that the judge, if he so chose, could have imposed a sentence up to 80 years, 40 years on count one.
Did Wisconsin at that time have a procedure that was anywhere similar to our federal rule of criminal procedure 11, where a a lock-in plea is offered and a defendant gets a sentence that's above the agreed-upon number, he has the option to vacate the plea?
No, we don't, and we've never had it. It's always been a rule of Wisconsin law, and it's always made clear to pleading defendants that the judge is not bound by any sentence recommendation and that the judge could impose up to the maximum.
But now, I know it's a practice of a lot of Wisconsin judges that they're going to go far over the recommended range that they give a defendant an option of vacating the plea before it's accepted sentencing.
That's my understanding that some judges have done that or still do that.
A lot of Wisconsin judges.
And in fact, it's my understanding that there is a case working its way through the Wisconsin courts. In fact, it might even be before the Wisconsin Supreme Court, raising those kinds of issues about whether a defendant can be allowed to back out of a plea if the judge is dissatisfied with the sentence.
It's not backing out of a plea. It's a plea where both sides are agreeing on a certain. For instance, mm-hmm. a 10-year sentence. If you get a 10-year sentence, that's it. But if the sentence is going to be more than that, we give you an option to go to trial.
No, and Wisconsin does not have that. I don't know if Wisconsin ever will adopt that sort of a thing. And
what I'm saying is that a lot of Wisconsin trial judges mm-hmm. follow that as a normal procedure.
And I don't necessarily disagree with that approach. But obviously, that might prevent a lot of appeals, such as cases like this. However, as it stands now, as it stood at the time of Mr. Morales' plea, there is no such ability for him or any such procedure to allow them to lock in a certain given time. And in fact, the opposite is made clear that regardless of what anyone recommends or asks for, the judge is not required to follow it and can just sort of go his or her own way within the statutory maximum. So I guess unless there are any further questions.
Mr. Ryan, there is Ms. Ball's argument regarding timeliness. Did you want to respond to that? I read your brief.
Yeah. It's our position that she's right that it depends on whether you determine, whether you agree with the Wisconsin Court of Appeals with regard to his last habeas, the Knight petition, the habeas petition that the Wisconsin Court of Appeals said this should have been filed in the trial court. Now, I understand the court also addressed the merits, but I believe if you read the opinion, it also ends with basically the alternative holding that, you know, this really was filed in the wrong court. You're challenging the effectiveness of trial and post-conviction counsel. Basically, we're going to... It didn't say so many words, but basically we're going to dismiss this, and if you want to go back and file it the right way, you can. And I think that ties into the Johnson decision of this court that it was filed in the wrong court. Now,
The Wisconsin Court of Appeals addressed the merits of the petition.
Pardon me?
The Wisconsin Appellate Court addressed the merits of the Knight petition, didn't it?
It did. It addressed it, and then also it made alternative holdings.
Well, why go back to the trial court if that court already addressed it?
Because it's certainly conceivable that you could develop, if you make more specific allegations in the trial court, perhaps there are factual issues that aren't before the Court of Appeals or the Court of Appeals is unaware of that a trial judge might look at and say, you know, the Court of Appeals was correct as far as it goes, but you raise additional fact questions that we might have to have testimony regarding. So, I mean, as a practical matter, the court's probably telling him, as courts do with advisory opinions, you know, don't waste your time, but you can go ahead and do this if you want. But theoretically, at least, there might be additional fact issues that weren't before the Court of Appeals that could be litigated. Now, I don't know if the court received the new decision from the Wisconsin Court of Appeals. Actually, it was published in September after our brief was filed, the Panama v. Rep decision, which I must admit probably calls into some question that ruling, because now the Panama decision makes clear that pro se litigants challenging effectiveness of counsel on no merit appeals can file night petitions in the Court of Appeals, and then it'll be up to the Court of Appeals basically to sort it out and decide whether to take up the merits itself or send it back to the lower court for evidentiary hearings. This was decided, I think the Court of Appeals was correct in ruling that he had filed in the wrong court. I think today the Court of Appeals would say, well, that's fine.
Thank you very much, counsel.
I'm sorry. Thank you.
Anything further, Ms. Ball?
Starting with the Panama decision, clearly there's no procedural bar or procedural regularity in here that precludes Mr. Morales' federal habeas corpus petition. The Panama decision, if anything, underscores the wisdom of this court's decision in Page v. Frank, which says that Wisconsin does not apply its procedural bar in a principled way. The Panama decision looks at Rothering, Knight, Escalona, Tillman, and calls them circular, incongruous, cumbersome, confusing, and if they're unprincipled, this court doesn't apply them. And that's why the Knight petition remains valid and every other petition that Mr. Morales filed and how he gets into court on time. Apart from that, I would like to address opposing counsel's comment that there is no mandatory minimum sentence at issue here. That wasn't my argument. Everyone, I think, would agree that Mr. Morales was constitutionally entitled, to know the maximum potential penalty that he faced. This maximum carried with it a mandatory minimum of 40 years. He wasn't going to get out of it. He wasn't eligible for challenge incarceration, earned release, good time credits, nothing. That was clear on the statute. And that's a piece of information he wasn't told. And if you're Mr. Morales, it makes no sense to plead guilty if that's your maximum sentence, is potentially a life sentence, when there was an available defense. I agree with opposing counsel that the trial court was not required to accept the terms that the prosecutor offered. So it was very important to know what exactly that maximum potential penalty was. Now, Wisconsin has not, aside from the Court of Appeals, the Wisconsin Supreme Court has not said that the truth in sentencing law, the terms of that, are either collateral or direct consequence of pleading guilty. But we're not challenging the whole truth in sentencing system. You've got a very limited and unique situation here where this defendant pleads guilty to crimes that straddle two sentencing systems. And that's what sets this case apart from Hill, where the United States Supreme Court says that a court does not have an obligation to inform a defendant of parole ineligibility. Here, what happened was you have a prevailing system where it exists, a switch in the law. The defendant's not told of the switch in the law. And that switch in the law, for him, carried the mandatory minimum period of confinement of 40 years. Finally, Your Honors, if you get to the issue of prejudice on truth in sentencing, Mr. Morales, that it pled it at least three different times. It's in this record. You can see the affidavit that he submitted to the trial court that explains that he would not have pled guilty but for truth in sentencing problems. He also had it in his appellate brief, which is in the record, and he reiterated his allegations here in the district court in his petition for habeas corpus. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much, counsel. And Ms. Ball, we thank you for your willingness to accept the appointment in this case and your assistance to the court as well as your client. The case is taken under advisement.